It's that time of the year where all the spirits come out to play. A terror grips the streets, and your darkest fears come to life. Pull in close as we journey through the darkness into the realms of the Monster Cast.
And hello out there, everyone in podcast land, and welcome back to the Firmer Podcast, podcast for people who actually like movies, and the next episode of Monster Cast 2020 here on the Front Row Network. That's right, October Monster Cast month, where we go all things that go bump in the night. I'm Jeremy Gechner here, and with me as always for these horror film spotlights for the month of October, my wife, the person who got me to love horror films so, so much, Mrs. Sarah Baltusevich Gechner. Say hello to all the ghouls out there.
Hello to all the ghouls out there.
Look at that. So prim and proper every single time. You know what, Sarah? I had a blast talking Jeepers Creepers on our first one. That was our creature feature for the month. And now we're going to go into the realm of ghosts here. And I'm very excited about this one because there's a special section of this review. But first, let's tell them what we're talking about here. What is our ghost feature, our next Monster Cast podcast for the month?
That would be Hell House LLC.
Hell House LLC. Gotta say, one of my favorite films of the past couple of years. It is a found footage film written and directed by Stephen Cognetti. The reason why I'm very excited about this is because in addition to Sarah and I talking about this episode, you'll actually be hearing an interview I got to do with the director and writer himself, Stephen Cognetti, of this film. This is so freaking awesome that we get to talk to the guy. So we're going to actually get some questions that I think we're going to have to raise here, and we're going to see if he can answer them for us. But this film, 2015, tells the tale of a group of people who run a horror-themed haunted house.
There's non-horror themed?
I don't think so. It's a haunted house. Yeah, and so this we get the sense that this is a group. Technically, this movie is about a documentary crew making a documentary about an event that happens at this crew's house.
It's a found footage within a documentary.
That is a found footage. It's a little weird, but it actually works really, really well. But the main crux of the story that the documentary crew is telling is an incident that happened at this Hell House that was taking place about 40 miles outside of New York City, in the town of Abaddon, New York. And just this incident that cost, I think it was 15 people died in this incident on the opening night of this Hell House.
And it's all kind of shrouded in mystery.
Yeah, and nobody really knows what happens. Yeah,
so this documentary crew is kind of, you know, examining, looking inside it, and then they come across some tapes that have never been before seen.
Right, because one of the... The film is structured in such a way that, you know, the documentary crew is doing like these interviews with people who have been investigating this incident for the past couple of years.
You know, there's people who were outside when it happened that had taken some video.
People that were inside the house as too. And that there's really only one YouTube video from somebody that was in the house. Mm-hmm. There's a 911 call that happens from inside the house. But other than that, that's all that we know.
There's a lot of, you know, speculation. A couple of news crew members have broken into the house to get footage of the inside, but other than that, there's really not much.
Yeah, a photographer got busted into the house to take some pictures and everything, but that's about it. But then one of the original members of the crew that hasn't been seen.
The only female member, Sarah.
She hasn't been seen ever since this event happened, but she finds these documentary filmmakers and brings them the tapes of all of the footage that they shot as part of their crew for setting up this Hell House.
Yeah, and that kind is of like, kind of yeah, the main behind crux. The scenes, like fun footage that they took as this group of people were setting it up.
And yes, but of course,
never before seen.
Yes, but of course, the big crux here is that there's a lot of really creepy stuff that happens to this crew as they're trying to set up this Hell House, and it unfolds very, very fun there. Eventually, we do get to see what happened there. So that's the basic rundown here. Now, the reason why we're not going to do our typical shtick here of like breaking down the entire plot of a movie is because, well, it's a found footage film, and a lot of found footage films, the plot is pretty simple, and really the effectiveness of the movie, I find, comes from how well you pull off the basic tenets of a found footage film. So, Sarah, you know, found footage has become such a mainstay of the horror genre ever since, I guess you could say ever since Blair Witch Project really kind of popularized it. But in your mind, like, your first impressions of this movie, is it a good found footage horror film or one of the bad ones?
It's a good found footage horror film. This is one of the better ones. You're more of a found footage person than
me. I am. I'm very much
into it. I like them. It just has to be the right one. And I just think they've been overdone recently and not done well in a lot of cases.
Right.
But this one is done very well because it's simplistic.
Yes.
And that's what makes a found footage good. That's why Blair Witch was so good, because it's literally just three people in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. And, like, you know, other ones, like, but they do too much, you know, like Grave Encounters and stuff like that. It's like, it's just over the top. You know, and it's just, it's gotten to the point where found footage is just, it's gotten kind of tiring, and they're just, they've pushed it too far. But this one kind of goes back to the roots of the early found footage. Like, this one you could watch, and if you didn't know that it wasn't real, you probably, you know, would think, oh, it looks like a real, you know, like, it looks like it could really be what's happening, could be a real, just somebody's camera. And that's why it works so well. I think it's just the simplicity of it that makes it good.
Yeah, really, there's only one kind of, like, what you would call, I guess, a little horror ridiculousness, and that's at, like, the very, very end. But that's just kind of because, like, the last shots of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's only because, like, but that's a really good scare at the same time as
well. It's a good twist.
And it is a good twist. But you're right. I think that, like, you're right to bring up Blair Witch as a good example here, because, you know, the scares in this aren't overtly gross. They're not overtly bloody.
You honestly would miss them if you didn't.
Yeah, there's a ton of them that you do miss, even if you're looking for
them. That's what's great about it, because it's not so overt. It's just, like, it's barely there, and you really have to look for it.
Yeah, and so that was my question, is, like, what actually makes a found footage horror film good? So I think there's a few basic tenets that this movie really hits. One, you have to have an actual good, compelling reason for the camera to be rolling.
Correct.
And that this is,
and man, do they dig for those in these later
films. I know, and this is like, you would be surprised, I think, at, like, how many found footage horror films just forget this basic tenet of the found footage
thing. There has to be a reason why
the filming is happening.
I mean, like, the new Blair Witch, where they, like, use the drone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, yeah, it's a cool shot, but it's also like, man, we're trying so hard to have a reason to put a camera on this.
I know,
you know,
right?
It's like, okay. Like, this one is literally just, like, a group of five friends whose job, who they make their entire living for the year putting on haunted houses. And they usually did in New York City. This year they move it to a smaller town, and it's just like them documenting their journey.
Yeah.
And it's most of the time the camera's on, it's just them, like, dicking around and having fun.
Yeah. And they actually even bring that up when, like, one of the actresses, like, says, like, you know, why are you filming all this? And the leader of the group, Alex, he's just kind of like, you know, it's for us, you know, we review it for next year, it's for ideas, you know, maybe something for the website and stuff. And so it's fun. And look, it's not like I couldn't nitpick and find, like, a few shots where, like, okay, well, why is the camera rolling there?
Of course.
But there is a compelling reason why
we
overall,
see all
this footage.
You don't think that when you're watching this. I don't think you sit through this movie and be like, okay, there's no reason for that. That happens a lot of times.
A lot of found footage movies. Yeah, and so I think, so that's the first basic tenet of a found footage film that I think has to exist there.
And it works well, too, with, like, the documentary part, too. Like, the film within a film thing, it's great.
And I'll tell you, I think it's, like, the beginning of this movie that really kind of makes it work, is, like, the way that they, like, put through, like, news, like faux news footage, faux interviews with experts and witnesses and stuff, it really leads you to be like, oh my god, yeah, what happened here? Like, 15 people died, like, nobody knows.
And then, like, you get that setup, and then it's like, oh, here's these tapes, and you're like, oh, this is the actual crux of the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of like, oh, this, okay, yeah.
I thought I was watching, like, this faux, like, you know,
documentary.
Yeah, here thing, but now, oh, we actually get to see all the action here.
Yeah.
And again, like, the way that they, like, you know, they give you the YouTube video of the person that was in the house, but they didn't see, like, a ton of stuff. It's mostly just a bunch of people panicking and screaming and running out. Then you also get this 911 call that somebody from in the house, and, like, the line that always gets me from this is, like, there's, like, some garbled static, but then you hear something saying, like, into the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I really want to ask the director about this, because it's like, am I supposed to infer what I think from that, like, people are, like, getting dragged into the walls of this hotel, like, because that's kind of weird and really creepy. But other than that, so like both of those things, all of a sudden you just have this innate curiosity of like, well, yeah, what the hell happened here? You know, if 15 people died from this and nobody knows,
I mean, guess
the police
what?
Are covering it up.
You still don't really even get an answer.
No, and I think that that's also really good because yeah. that's the other tenet, which you already talked about, simplicity.
Yeah, you're simplicity. Not seeing actual ghosts or actual, you know.
You do a few times, but it's just glimpses.
Kind of, though.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't even know that. Like, it's just.
Yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely the simplicity that makes it good.
Yeah, and the scares in this are very simple but very effective. And
if you, yeah.
And you know,
when
and
you see it's like one of those pictures when you look and you're like, when you see it, oh
yeah,
God.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh God. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And well, and you already said that, you know, like I'm a big fan of the found footage horror genre. And the reason is because, you know, I find that when you're watching a horror film that's just a straight up narrative film, you are always like the passive observer. You're always on the outside of the story. You're watching something happen to somebody else. With a found footage film, when it's done right, you feel like you're the person in danger because you have that limited view of sight and everything. You can only see what the camera is seeing. And so, you know, when you have something where it's like, oh my God, did I just see a shadow in the corner? Oh man, like the strobe light effect when Paul is first trying to go through the house and stuff. And, you know, all of a sudden this guy, this creepy guy just all of a sudden appears and disappears. Then appears and disappears, you know, like it's that kind of stuff. You're just like, ugh, I'm uncomfortable. I want to get out of here, but I can't because the camera won't leave, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, you're right. It's you're kind of along for the ride with them. And like, I mean, I'm a bigger fan of just like the narrative horror movie.
Sure, yeah.
But that's just because that's what I grew up on. But you're right. With a narrative horror movie, you don't really have a chance to like find those scares. They're pretty over. And you know, the thing about a found footage is that there's not a score.
Yep.
So it's just kind of like the ambiance. It's just there and it happens. Like, you know, in a regular horror movie, usually when something scary happens, you get like a bah, you know,
yeah, and a big stinger.
So
yeah.
Without that, yeah, it definitely makes it more unnerving without
yeah.
that.
Yeah. And this one, actually, they're able to use a little bit of a score because it's a documentary putting this footage together.
Yep.
And so they intercut with these interviews and stuff, and they actually do add a little bit of underscore to like really give the gravity of the situation, you know, like when they're talking to the photographer and he's talking about going through this house that's been boarded
sure.
up.
In the documentary section there is, but in yeah. the actual raw
oh,
files.
Oh, no, yeah, but I'm just yeah. saying it's like that's a new interesting wrinkle to this is that they get to kind of give some like movie production to it. You know, they get to have a little bit of movie production fun with it. And it's just, again, it just I have to give the director here a lot of credit because the way he intersperses these interviews and these like commentary sections in the middle of the footage, it's really, really good to give us more and more context in light of the story. But then it also really makes us care about the characters too.
Yeah.
Because they always keep talking about like the yeah. tragedy of all of this, that all these people are dead now and nobody knows why.
Yeah. It's just like a group. It's literally just like a group of friends.
Yeah. And I think that's the other big reason why this movie works, because these people have great chemistry
yeah,
together.
Yeah. They're all hilarious.
And I think you got the cast list here because like, I really want to call out all of these actors here. So the leader of the entire Hell House is Alex. And he is played by,
these aren't in like the,
yeah, they're not really in narrative order.
Danny Bellini
there. His girlfriend, Sarah Hovell, is played by Ryan Jennifer Jones. And then he has three employees with him there. Tony, played by Jared Hacker. And then his childhood friend, McNamara, who is played by Andrew Schneider.
Adam Snyder.
And then the actual basic narrator of most of this movie, Paul, played by Gore Abrams. And I gotta say, right off the bat here, bravo, Gore.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
Because he is
by far the best
hilarious.
Part. He's just, you know, he's just like your typical, like, bro.
Yeah, he's just, but it's not like a douchey
no,
guy either.
No.
He's just kind of like, you want to hang around this guy.
He
you
just,
know
like,
you're
reminds me of, like, the guys I grew up with, like, the group of guys that, because, like, I'm the one girl. I have two brothers, and then, like, every group of all my parents' friends had boys.
Mm-hmm.
One friend had five boys, one friend had four boys, one friend had two boys. So it's just like, he reminds me of, like, those guys that I grew up with.
Yeah.
They're just, like, the guys, and they're
yeah,
funny.
But
they're
really
hilarious.
Fun-loving,
just, like,
yeah.
Likes to, like, you know, just party and drink a beer. And,
uh-huh.
Like, like, you know, he likes what he does. They're all good at what they do. But I mean, if they're running haunted houses in New York City, they obviously are good at what they do.
You got to kind of be good at that.
But yeah, he's just, you know, he's along for the ride to make money, but he also like really, you know, it's just fun.
Yeah, exactly. And like when we like start getting like all this, like the very first thing we see from this footage is him playing like this guess the movie game with Sarah. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, it's just like, it's just a lot of fun bantering back where he's trying to get her to guess I Am Legend and she thinks it's Escape from New York and he's like, she thinks it's a Kurt Russell joint and stuff like that. And the way he talks, like,
yeah, he's funny.
He has some great, great jokes, but also he's kind of like the most tragic character of this movie because he's the one that gets, I guess, taken and possessed, I guess.
Yeah, isn't he like missing for a while?
Yeah, he's missing for a while and he shows back up and then he's kind of the facilitator of a lot of at least Sarah's death, we know, at the end of the movie. But I mean, like, he is just very, very funny. And I think, again, you need someone like that at the center of a film like this. You need someone that you can just laugh with, that just makes you feel at ease, because there's a lot of tension that starts happening in this movie. And a lot of it comes from, you know, just like really simple scares, like you said, like the clowns, basically, that keep moving, the clown mannequins that keep moving in and out of the house and stuff.
And Paul's like one of the only ones that like really talks directly to the camera, because he's the cameraman.
Yeah.
And he has, you know, he like often turns it on, like on him in his room at night, like just to like give a, at first it starts like joking out, like he's like, I need a bang.
Yeah,
it's
man.
Like, I hope one of these actresses is boneable. Yeah.
You're right.
He's like,
it's just such like
Sarah's
a fun
hot,
look.
But Alex won't share.
Won't share, yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's great. Like he just kind of like gives these like funny narratives, but like what's great about that is that they start out so lighthearted, but then they start to like get, you know, like by the time he does the second one, you see like a figure in his doorway. Mm-hmm. And what's great about it is that like he doesn't see it because he's just, you don't, he's looking at the camera. It's all in the background.
Yeah.
And then eventually, like, you know, like I think it's Sarah that ends up in his room, like sitting against, or Melissa,
I've never known. Is that who it's supposed to be?
I think it's that actress.
Like somebody there that, well, I mean, it's clearly like a ghost of some kind, but like taking
on
the appearance.
Yeah, it's like a girl, I don't know, but like a girl's randomly sitting in his room. And then like you just see like him just like kind of like over the course of these little like self interviews, like getting worn down by it.
Yeah. And he especially keeps getting more and more worn down.
Yeah,
and then Tony's the one that kind of starts getting more and more worn down after Paul goes missing and reappears and stuff. But yeah. And I mean, like it all leads up to this giant crescendo of the opening night. And this is finally where we get to like cut all the footage together. And it's just a beautiful amount of chaos here that they pull off here. And they get like merge together all the shots that we've seen previously, like a lot of the out of context stuff we saw
kind
in that YouTube
in
video.
Yeah,
and it puts it in order and stuff, and it's a lot of great context there. But so here's two big questions that I want to ask about this movie before we get to you know, the interview with Steven here. So, you know, I think that one of the, like I said, the scares in this are very, very simplistic. So which one stood out the most to you, like when it comes to this, and like why do you think they were so effective?
Well, like you mentioned the clowns. So the clown, like I think it's just like the small things, like the clown's head turning.
Yeah.
It's just like that kind of just, you know, it's like, what the hell?
Yeah,
like,
well, specifically the very first one where Paul is like going, and again, like it, structuring it this way, he's like just going through, like kind of showing all the stuff that they've already done, and he's just making these actually pretty funny jokes, like throughout, like
just messing.
Goes like through this toilet room, and he's just like, this room looks shitty, you know?
But like, yeah, just like noticing that small thing, it's just like,
yeah. So he comes around.
That's the first real sign of something unnerving.
Yeah, so he like comes around the corner there towards the basement corridor stairway, and one of those clown mannequins that we've already established their heads won't turn.
Right.
On the mannequin is just standing there, like looking down the stairway, and he thinks that it's Paul, or no, he thinks that it's Tony. In just kind of messing with him. And then when he comes back up, you know, from looking down the stairway, the camera comes back up. The clown's head is turned towards Paul, and he's like, "Oh God, you got me, man!"
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so clearly we're like, "Okay, well, that's got to be Tony in there." And so he's just like, "Okay, weirdo, like, let me know when you want to get back to work." And as he goes back through the house again, all of a sudden he sees Tony hanging out with McNamara. And again, this guy, Gore Abrams, he sells this so well. He's just like, what the hell? What? Like, no, like he freaks out like you naturally would, because when he goes back, the clown isn't there.
Yeah.
And now it's back downstairs in the basement.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's the kind of stuff, you're right. Like, if that happened to you, you would freak out exactly like Paul freaks out there.
Yeah. And like, you know, he doesn't want, like, at first he's just like, You know, it's just that same trope of, like, wanting to believe that somebody's messing with you, mm-hmm. but then, like, seeing that they're not, like, the fear that hits you when that happens. And yeah. it's so good. It's just, like, your gut falling out of your butt. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, it's just like, what the hell, man?
Yeah, and I think the other one that gets me is just, the piano. Like, he has this melody on the piano. He's, like, messing with, like, another dummy that's Hector, sitting at the piano. And yeah. he's like, like this melody that it's probably like the one thing he can play. You know how everybody right. has like that one thing
that they one
can
thing sit, you
like
remember.
You always play Defying Gravity. Everybody has like that one thing that they can sit down and play. This is probably it for Paul. And it's like, he plays it a couple times, like just like, you know, in the early stages of things. But then later on, like when he's missing, you hear it.
Yeah. You hear it down there like playing. And like the second they get to the piano room, all of a sudden there's nobody there.
Yeah, it's freaking.
And it's just had the Hector dummy sitting there. And even as they're exploring the room and turn their backs to him, then the piano plays again.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that's the kind of stuff that's just so effective and good there, because these people, yeah, it would freak you out. And then there's also that great section in the middle where the dummy keeps moving again,
mm-hmm.
where they're like finding Sarah down in the dining room, like sleepwalking and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And she's also talking, it sounds like, backwards. And I found out, I went through some Reddit searching here to figure out what she was saying. And apparently, if you play it backwards, it's the lines that she says to the interviewers at the beginning of the movie, talking about like how, like, you know, like they got me out of the house real quick. I was just like grateful to be alive, you know, stuff
really?
Like that. So that's kind of freaky, but it's all played backwards. So I mean, ugh.
Yeah. And then I think, of course, the ending with her is pretty unnerving too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 The ending is very unnerving.
Just like, you know, like them asking the hotel clerk, like, is she in this room? And then being like, there's nobody yeah, staying.
We don't have like room numbers that have letters.
So then
them,
you
yeah.
think in your head, okay, she's in that house. Like, what is she dead? Is she just and, living
okay, so
there?
And so this is my second question to you is like, what do you think this is? Because, like, look, we get this backstory of, like, the hotel was owned by this guy, Andrew Tully. A bunch of guests were going missing, including a woman and her young daughter. They were questioning him about it and everything, and the business dried up so much that he actually ended up hanging himself. But the urban legend around this is that Tully was, like, into kind of Satanist stuff, and that he chose this hotel in particular because, of course, in the Bible and
the
in satanic
Abaddon
lore. Yeah.
There's, like, the Knight of Hell, the Guardian of the Gates of Hell.
Into the gates of hell, yeah.
Yeah, so, I don't know. Like, that's...
Yeah,
so,
I mean, but that's, like, the lore there. So, what do you think we're seeing, like, as these ghosts keep... I mean, I don't know. Are they ghosts? Are they demons? Are they cult members with supernatural powers? Like, because, you know... Most of this stuff, you know, like the very first thing we see is like when they're first touring the hotel and we go past a hallway and a room and you see like a dark hooded figure.
Hoodie, yeah.
And the documentary crew like freeze frames it and stuff. But when Paul's in like the strobe light room, like this person keeps appearing, but they've got kind of like this grotesquely decaying face on them. And I don't know if it's a mask or if it's
yeah,
meant to be that.
I definitely don't think that there's like people, that it's people, like
yeah.
living people.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's, like, members of the satanic cult that are dead that are inhabiting the house, or if it's just, like...
Demons,
or just, like, ghosts of the people that went missing.
Well, and that's true, because we do see one of those ghosts of the... Because when they're... Because when the house is going nuts, McNamara and Tony are trying to run to the basement, and as they do, they go through the dining room, they see a little girl dressed in, like, an old-timey dress.
Yeah.
And again, this is something I didn't see it to like my like fourth time watching this movie because I really like this movie and like yeah like I didn't even notice that, but it's just like, oh my god, what the hell. So yeah, there's clearly ghosts here.
Yeah, so that is kind of, I tend to skew towards the ghost explanation.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't know,
because we have all these shrouded figures. I mean, like, there's you know, when they first tour the basement, there's all the satanic or the kind of symbols and stuff drawn on the walls. There's a bunch of Bibles down there, so you get the sense, and especially because of what happens in the basement when we finally get to see it, you know, the actress Melissa is, I mean, seemingly, I guess, sacrificed in some way. We don't really get to see that. But as the tour goers get down there, there's all these hooded figures. Melissa's screaming to them, it's not part of the show.
Right.
And, you know, eventually they, and I had to freeze frame it because when the camera falls down, you see her not in the cuffs anymore, but kind of like held in like this almost crucifix position, like against another wall.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, we get to see like kind of a grotesque, like, demon-y face on one of these hooded figures that's down in the basement.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like, demons or...
ghosts.
And also, like, you remember when Sarah is beaten to a pulp by Paul with the camera?
Yeah.
There's some kind of thing that walks past her growling, like a very animalistic growl that mm-hmm. then pulls her out of the frame.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess demons makes the most sense, right?
Probably, I would say, like... maybe, or like, all. The cult members have become demons, but
sure,
then
sure.
The ghosts are the people that were sacrificed there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
That's
that makes
like, sense. That was my kind of...
And trust
of...
me, I'm going to ask Steven this because I want to know, but...
So, yeah, so, like, as far as Sarah goes, like, is she, like, a ghost when she goes
yeah,
to
yeah, because
the...
how does she get to go to this documentary people?
Right, like, she clearly leaves the house, and yeah. she's, like,
and
there
well,
talking
and you'll remember... And, okay, so there's a few
I mean,
times...
she looks like hammered shit. She doesn't look like she got beat with a camera, but she looks creepy, and she
yeah,
just
and
has,
she's
like...
talking creepy.
She's just completely emotionless.
Yeah,
yeah.
exactly. Because you remember, and there's hints about this throughout the movie, because, you know, like, they find a plate when they're first going through the house, and they're like, oh, it kind of looks like Sarah. Maybe it could be your grandmother. Mm-hmm. And then there's this part where they're trying to shoot a commercial for the house in a field, and Sarah goes off to this, like, kind of Virgin Mary statue
yeah.
and she's like, looks like she's talking to it. When they call her name, she just kind of like kid-like almost runs away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like, and, you know, when she's first interviewed by these people, she says, you know, I've been staying with family mostly mm-hmm. and I'm in a better place now.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very, I don't know exactly what to think is happening.
She has some connection to it.
Because
or...
don't get me wrong, like, Paul beats the hell out of her at the end. Like, I don't think there's a way you survive that.
Well,
meeting.
I mean, and even if she did, like, wouldn't she, like, have wounds when she goes
yeah,
to the...
and I mean, when they see her at the very end, she's got kind of a cut on her cheek, but that's definitely more, less wounds than she had
right.
at the end of the
so
footage.
I don't know if it's, like, she's, like, a ghost, like, trying to lead people back to the house for more, like,
that's
victims?
What, that would be assumed, right?
I mean, guess, but, yeah, I don't know. And so, like, she's living there, but, like, are the rest of them, like, ghosts in the house, too? Or mm-hmm. is it just her?
No, that's a good question.
You like, know?
Yeah, like,
but she's, like, staying in the same room.
Where's
that, like,
Alex
she's
and
with
Paul
Alec.
And McNamara?
Yeah.
yeah. Like, all of that.
I don't know. So that's...
So who knows?
That's a question that I have.
Question that we need to get
unanswered
there.
Question.
And, you know, there's another effective scare that I want to call out, which is when, McNamara and Tony are having to search for Paul and stuff after he's gone missing. They're in the basement and they're kind of like searching the cellar. And as Tony turns around, all of those clown mannequin heads are turned
mm-hmm.
like to look at him. And he like freaks out. He pushes McNamara into the cellar. And then of course, when they get back out there, all the heads are normal. And he's literally just like, fuck, like, you know? Like,
yeah. At this point, they're just done.
Yeah.
And it's just like a trap because it's like, you know, they needed this. Like they talk about how like, you know, like they haven't been making the money that
yeah.
they
there's
have.
That implication
really
that scene with Tony and McNamara. That's literally the only scene in the movie where I think like you could make the case like, okay, why is the camera rolling here? But you know, like,
yeah.
but maybe it's just like on. You know, they never turned it off because
well,
Mac like
you're
ran
asking
after
yourself
him.
As you watch this, like all this shit is happening. Why do they not?
Yeah,
just
why
leave?
Don't they just cut tail
but
and
that's
run?
Why?
yeah.
Because they need it.
Yeah, because Alex has been losing money with the house, and you know, he thinks that maybe being cheaper out here, but still charging pretty good, you know, but not having to pay, like, New York rates will help him. At least that's what I'm assuming.
Right.
But yeah, like, you know, Tony has to have that realization of, like, oh, God, we can't leave. Like,
yeah,
we have to keep doing this.
Yeah.
Man, I just love this movie. Are there anything in the movie that doesn't work for you, that kind of loses you a little bit? Not really
no.
for me. I mean, like, anything I would have would just be, like, minor gripes like we've been talking about, you know, like...
Yeah, I mean, it's just, like, we were talking about the Sarah thing. I think I would have liked to know more of, like, what the deal is with her. Like,
mm-hmm.
the fact that she's, like, pretty much really weird the entire time.
She is.
And it just, that, for me, is just a little bit like...
Maybe we could use a little more context here.
Yeah,
but at the same time, though, you're right. Like, part of the greatness of the ending of this movie is that you don't really get to fully know what happens here, even after you've seen the footage.
I feel like that works better for me, though, like, the ending of her just staying there, like, if there wasn't so much weirdness throughout her. She was just, like, you know, normally behaving that way, and then in the end, it's like, oh, God, she's stuck in there now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? I don't know, but...
No, that would be interesting.
I don't know.
Me.
I feel like this like connection with her is just really kind of lost. I don't know. It's just, it's not, it's done, it's there, but it's not enough. And it's like, that's the only thing for me that's kind of like,
yeah, kind of, you're right. Like they hint at it enough where you think there's going to be a bigger payoff.
Yeah, I agree.
And again, like that's not even like a huge gripe.
It's not a gripe.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of like,
it's just like the same thing I always say on our,
used more here.
Are You Afraid of the Podcast episodes? Like, I want more background. You know me, I love my background.
Yeah, we got to get that lore in there, man.
Yeah, I love that lore. So yeah, that's really, I mean, I don't know. I think, like we said, what makes it good is that the scares are minimal. You know, mm-hmm. I do wish we knew more of what was happening. Like, is this Tully and his, or is this something else? Is this what caused Tully to go insane?
Yeah,
is
exactly.
This place just haunted from the beginning, or is it haunted because this guy killed himself?
Oh, yeah.
I think, you know, maybe some more lore, but yeah. in general.
And, you know, full disclosure, there are two more films in this series. We haven't seen them yet.
But
and I assume they probably do go more into a little bit detail of the
maybe
backstory. We'll have to watch those. But yeah, I think that, You know, like, found footage can so easily be done bad, as we've seen multiple times over the years.
I like hesitate all the time to watch found footage with you, because I know you love them, and I like them too, but you gotta find a good one, because it takes away, and you get burnt out by them when you just keep watching bad ones.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, like, it became so in vogue after the Paranormal Activity movie, like, you really kind of brought it back after Blair Witch. And
Paranormal Activity is one of those that's like, they try so hard to find reasons to have the camera on.
Exactly. And that's kind of where,
like, the fourth one, it's like,
okay,
why?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like, I also do, like, think that now, you know, we're living in a society where people love to record themselves. And, you know, like, and so there's creative ways you can do this now, where you can have it.
Like,
so
we've watched
several
of those movies that just take place only on, like, the computer and phone.
Yeah, like
searching.
Unfriended and stuff, or Searching. Yeah, those are actually kind of very clever.
They're interesting because, I mean, you're right. Nowadays, like, I mean, if you don't have a smartphone, then you're in the giant minority. And most
you
people are
74
glued
years old
to those things, like, all day. It's kind of sad, actually.
Yeah.
But it, you're right. It works better now, found footage, because there is a reason. Because we're all just jackasses who film everything we do and take pictures of our food and our kids poop in the potty. Like, ridiculous stuff like that.
Oh, man. We struck a nerve here, folks.
No, I'm just saying, like, there are more reasons now. They aren't good reasons, but they're there.
Sure, exactly. But this is definitely a very, like, diamond in the rough, like, you know, in all of the fine brush of crappy found footage films that we've gotten.
I think we watched
this one's just kind of out there, and
it's
great.
This came out in 2015, which is the year we got married, and we had no kids, so we watched a lot more. We did a lot more things.
Yes.
I remember watching, like, several, like, found footage movies that year, and, like, they were all starting to kind of run together, and then I remember watching this one and being like, okay,
like that. And it's very unassuming. Like, you wouldn't really think, like you know, the cover art I think is great, but, like, you wouldn't really think that, like, okay,
yeah,
this
I just
is
remember
a
being
gem.
Like, okay, honey, really another one.
Hell House LLC. And yeah, it was just on these lists of, like, oh, here's a found footage film that you need to see. And
yeah,
I'm glad we did, because this is a rare gem of a movie. Like,
it's
very good. It's very minimal, but it also has a reason to exist, and that's the key parts about this.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Well, any last thoughts before we get to our interview with Steven?
Nope. Go for it.
Yeah, I don't think so either. So, all right. What you're about to hear is my interview with Steven Cognetti, the writer and director of Hell House LLC. And welcome back, everyone. As promised in the first part of this episode, we are now joined by the writer and director of the very movie we're talking about here, the writer-director of Hell House LLC, Mr. Steven Cognetti. Steven, thank you so much for being on MonsterCaster on the Front Row Network on NPR Illinois.
Hey, awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Steven, I'm always just so interested in people who make films, make entertainment and art, just knowing how they got there. So very quickly, just give us Steven's superhero origin story. How did he become the writer and director of films for the masses?
I think anybody who's made films knows that it's a very tricky, complicated industry, hard to get into. So most of us, we just do it independently, any way we can, just try to get a film made as, you know, as low budget, as possible. most of us starting out have to deal with these low budgets. So and that further complicates because making movies costs a lot of money, but, it's a tough, frustrating, I'm pretty sure making Hell House took years off my life. It's very, the stress of indie filmmaking is a lot too, but, it's just, years of, writing, trying to write that, that horror story that I've always wanted to write, the horror movie that I always wanted to see myself, kind of putting in the little elements that I loved throughout, being a fan of horror for so long, you know, starting, with novels and then movies, but, and then trying to just, what do I like the most, and piecing it in into a story that I wanted to see, and then trying to make it happen. And it took years to happen, but it finally, when we did, once we made it and completed it, then it took a few years to even be seen by anyone after that. So it's a long process. Filmmaking is tough. It's fun. It's a challenge, but that's fun too.
Yeah, I've been a DIT and an editor on a few like low budget films, and I can't even imagine being a director because it's absolutely insane what
no, all the stuff that goes on. You guys, I love that part of it. Editing is itself a frustrating task. I love editing as well. So anyone on the post production side, they have their own mountains, the whole industry. No matter if you're directing, if you're a cinematographer, actor, whatever, it's just a funky industry. It just has its own tricks and complications to achieve, you know, get to something inside of it. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's dive here into the movie Hell House LLC. My wife and I just spent the last 30 minutes of this episode raving on this film. It really is truly one of my favorite films of the past 5 years. Just so effective. I just keep going back to it to try and find stuff that I might have missed. But I got to say, I think it's such an effective film on so many levels, but probably the most stark is how well it works as a found footage in the found footage genre, you know, and especially at a time when that genre can seem so tired and so like easily unimaginative. Was the plan always to make this a found footage film, or did that kind of evolve over the course of writing the film?
That evolved over the course of writing. I wanted to make a haunted house film, and the first draft of it was not found footage. It was just standard, a narrative and shot narratively. And then I realized it just wasn't working. I didn't like that original script. I kept some of the elements, kept some of the scares from the script, and I turned it into something I do like, which is unsolved mysteries, true crime shows, documentaries on that side. So I just went the angle of the documentary. And then I found that was just making the script, like, you know, the pages were writing themselves, the story was writing themselves when I went at that angle. And once you find that angle that makes the story, you know, that just breathes new life into a story, and then, you know, I was able to finish the script, clean it up here and there. But finding that right angle, how to tackle the story, that was the turning point of the script.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the aspect that makes this one of the best found footage films I've seen in a long time is that you answer those two fundamental questions that most of them never answer at the very beginning, which is why is the camera always on, and how are we seeing this footage now? And well, that stark at the beginning. So like, was that like very important to you very early on?
The most important thing going into when I knew it was going to be a found footage film, the most important thing, and I had already had an appreciation for found footage films before I turned it that way. Gave me the idea that what inspired me towards the documentary side was a film called Lake Mungo. Mm-hmm. So successful in what they did and was so terrifying. I love that film. And then when I realized with my story, I was feeling like, well, you know, Lake Mungo was so effective as a documentary. Let's try that angle and see how that works. But the thing I wanted to do the most when I set out to do was I want to know how is the audience seeing this film. I want that explained. It's just not just raw film, raw footage is discovered and blah, here it is. I think it makes more sense that the film is edited by someone and then presented to the audience, and that is explained. Like the film, not the footage, just not just found. It's actually assembled by someone and then presented to the viewer, and that's how we're seeing. That was very important to me going into it, and as well as. And I think that's everything with rewrites and the script and everything is making sure that why the camera's running makes sense. And, anybody can nitpick any movie, and especially Hell House, and say, I don't think they'd make the camera running that. And that's fair. It is very tough to make, to justify that for the full 90 minutes. But we tried our hardest to make sure the story made sense to the camera filming, and, we did our best on it. That's what I'm trying to say.
I think it absolutely works. And you also made use of, the head cams, like they would be doing. But you give a good reason that, Alex wants all this documented. And, you say that so early with the character of Paul, who, by the way, just love that guy to death.
Yeah, he's great. He's a great actor, great guy in set, too. And, he's a great character.
Yeah, so I'm always interested in, the mechanics of this, too, because obviously you have Paul as the de facto cameraman in the narrative sense. But, when you're actually filming these, do you have an actual director of photography? Is the actor just kind of, standing there with him? Or do you, just give the actor the camera like that?
Yeah, that was something that was debated a lot before we went in to filming. And, we have a cinematographer, Brian Harnick, who's very talented. He's gone on to make, but much bigger films, a found footage film. I always say, whenever we're talking with a cinematographer about found footage, I'm like, I know found footage film is not your dream project, I've worked with so many different camera people, cinematographers on these films, though. I think what it is in this sense, the cinematographer usually, and I know this is true on three as well, is that they'll set the lighting, they'll set the stage, and they'll set the lighting in such that the person who's either is going to hold the camera, whether it is the cinematographer or the actor themselves, would have full range to move the camera around and really not to worry about too much of the lighting setup, either because it's above or below or, cleverly hidden in some way. So I think in one, probably the majority of the filming was done by Paul.
Really? Oh, that's awesome.
And I think that made it feel more natural. And I think in Paul, Gore Abrams, the actor, he liked it. He enjoyed it. And so whenever we had downtime, we're shooting something else that didn't involve the five actors, he would take a camera and they would go off and shoot some improv stuff amongst themselves somewhere else. And they really enjoyed playing with the camera, using the camera. And they were all just a great group. Very, had a good friendship among them going in that it was, it worked in that sense as well.
Yeah. Well, just tee up my next questions. Why don't you, the guy? Cause I wanted to ask you right there about the cast. They have such an awesome chemistry. I think it really makes us care for them, right off the bat, very quickly in this, just that joking nature, when they're in the car, just doing the movie guessing game and stuff, and, arguing about directions and stuff. It's all just so very real here. Did that come very naturally to them? Did they have to kind of adapt to the found footage style of acting, or did you give them room to improv?
I think most of them, if not all, had improv experience. So, and that was one of the, and it, the casting process for Hell House was very long. Very involved. We would bring in actors, so many actors a day, and just go through so many people and just really looking for someone who does have that. Someone you could think I know this person can riff.
Right.
If there's a messed up line, that messed up line is not going to cause a cut. That messed up line is going to turn into an awesome riff,
right.
If we're just rolling and it's going to seem natural, keep that camera rolling, make that gaff seem natural. And we're also looking for that on top of just can they just recite lines? What can they do when something's thrown at them? So the casting process involved a lot of scripted scenes and also a lot of improv scenes. So, for instance, Alex, his last audition, he had to I just asked him one question. Why did you want to get into making haunted houses? And he just had to answer that and just come up with a reason why he loves the haunt industry and wanted to make haunted houses. He wasn't prepared for that. He didn't know that question was coming, but he did it so beautifully. We knew that he was going to be someone who's going to interact with others very well. They didn't have much time together before we started shooting. We had one table read, and then I put them all in the car out of New York City, out to the shooting location, which is about an hour and a half, 2 hour drive. So, I had them play games with each other too, like road games, just like they would in the car. So they had that little road trip, mini road trip to bond a little bit. And then as shooting went on, they were just kind of hitting it off together, always hanging out offset. back at the hotels, you know, after dinner, they would all go to the local bar together. They just, it was really, and to this day, they're still a close group.
Oh, awesome.
They still stayed in touch. So, yeah.
Oh, that's so
awesome. Just lucky, a process of you know, it's a luck, a process of casting is that sometimes you just pick that great group that hits it off. I think that the process, it paid off. We spent a lot of time trying to find those right actors, and it paid off.
Well, I think you found some great actors there. They work really well together in the movie.
They're really talented guys.
Yeah, but also I think the sixth character of this movie is the hotel itself, the Abaddon Hotel. You know, it's such a stark character in the film, I think. And, you know, and I'm assuming this location really exists. It's an actual haunted house attraction, right?
It's in Pennsylvania, yeah. It's a haunted house attraction. That's the whole thing in the pre-production when I had the script done. The next thing I did after that was find out where am I going to shoot that. This is before I started casting. The first thing was like, well, where am I going to find this abandoned place to shoot? And I was actually looking at abandoned places. And then I realized at some point, a light went off in my head. Like even if you find a perfect abandoned place, you're never going to be able to shoot there. Logistically, it's never going to happen. Not like there's like lawsuits waiting to happen. There's, you know, there's probably not going to be any electricity. Like, why don't you find a place that's actually functioning, but just looks abandoned? And so that was my own, like, eureka moment. And like, why have I ever wasted my time looking for, like, actual abandoned places? But so then I started reaching out to haunted houses, because a lot of these haunted houses, they have really cool exteriors. Some of them have really cool exteriors. Some of them just have cool interior, not both. But with the haunting at the Waldorf Estate of Fear, which is in Lehighton, Pennsylvania. I reached out to a woman named Angie Moyer who runs the haunt, and she invited me over to take a tour of it. And I realized right then, like, this is perfect. Not only is it perfect just like how it looks, but like for the logistics of shooting, all of our casting crew were coming out of New York City, and this place was only an hour and a half, 2 hours right outside the city. So like it's very accessible from the city. And so it worked for so many reasons, but I always tell new filmmakers, from my own experience, what I have making my first feature is I shot in that small town of Lehighton, and that turned out to be a really wonderful experience because it's just like small towns are just like easier to deal with. They're not going to be on you about shooting here or there. There's a lot of them want to help out, and they're very nice. And that's what you need. You need to get all those breaks you can when you're on a low budget indie film. Yeah. You need the surrounding people to be not be antagonistic towards you, but to actually want to help. So
yeah,
so that was great. It was a great experience finding that hotel in the town.
Absolutely. Well, the stuff that happens in the hotel is also just so effective. Again, and I think that the scares, I think they're so effective, but they're not over the top. You know, they're very, you've built some great atmospheric horror in here, and it kind of makes everything, no matter how like innocent or kind of maybe even mundane, like makes it seem a little off and a little, you know, dangerous and such. So like, was your aim to be as subtle as possible with these scares? Is that what you were trying to do there? Or did it just kind of happen?
Every day when we started, the first thing I said is, remember, subtlety is everything. and that when I said earlier that I wanted to make the film that I wanted to see myself, and I kind of felt that there are a lot of horror movies but a lot of horror movies were just over the top and trying to scare you with bringing up the loud noise at the right time, the loud music at the right time, and nothing that was genuinely scary. And I was talking about like something that was genuinely terrifying to me, like, of recent back when I was filming this or writing this, was I can't remember the film, but forget about that. now it's going to kill me. Now I'm not going to be able to let this go now.
I know. No, that's fine. That's fine.
the actress, and I can't even remember the actress's name. They're at the cabin, the girlfriend and his husband, and her boyfriend at the cabin.
Honeymoon? Is that it?
Not a honeymoon. They knock on the door, and it's the people, the bags over the head. They made a scene.
Oh, the strangers.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
I kept on saying like the outsiders. Like, this doesn't sound right. Strangers.
That's close.
Yeah, but like when she picks up the phone in that scene after the boyfriend already left the cabin, she picks up the phone and just in the camera, you see in the background they're already in the cabin, And nothing's done with the camera. There's no like music brought up to support that. And it's just such a terrifying shot.
Yeah, you barely see him too in the darkness there.
He's still in the background and they're not drawing attention to it. They're not doing anything. And like, that was like, I loved that. And I was like, I want more of that. I want to feel that kind of terror more. And it's something so subtle. And so I try to write scares like, and like Halloween does that so well with Michael Myers, just seen in the background and places. And, and so many films do it so well. And that was really my drive, was to do it in Hell House, just get really subtle with the scares. Nothing that's going to just pop out and go, boo. Something that's going to just like slowly fill you with dread, but like without us really having to hit you over the head with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And like the one that I remember, the exact moment I first saw this movie, it was that very first big scare, as what I call it, which is Paul seeing the clown on the stairwell. And then his head turns when he puts the camera back. And literally that made me just go like, ah, nope, nope. Leave now, Paul, leave now. And like, and then he like, you know, he has such a great reaction to seeing Tony back on the couch there. But then he like runs straight into the basement. I'm like, no, don't go in the basement.
Oh,
like,
yeah, don't go check that out. Yeah.
Yeah, but that was great. And you use that clown so well throughout this. Like, and I'll fully full disclosure here, like my wife and I haven't watched the sequels yet because we're saving them for Halloween. Okay. But I do know, I've read a little that you go into more detail a little bit about that clown in the sequels. But did you have that in mind when you first shot this?
We use the clown a little bit in the sequels, but we don't go really into detail about any of where he came from or what he's doing.
Right.
He's used a little bit more in the sequels. The clown is the only thing that survived from the first draft of the script that I didn't like, the one where it wasn't a found footage. Mm. That's the only thing that survived throughout. And the scares with the clown, they were always there. So I think the first scare I ever wrote when I sat down to actually start writing Hell House was the scene in the middle of the night where they wake up and they see the clown standing at the bottom
on
steps.
The stairwell,
That is exactly as it was, the first time I wrote it, to all the drafts to like 2 years later when I locked the script, that never changed. And then I just added more into it, playing around with it. And the other thing too about subtlety, the clown itself was supposed to be subtle. The clown was supposed to have no exaggerated features, you know, not like a big clownish nose, no colors, just like a white face and like maybe some black features. And we were able to get that in through our makeup artist also, to be able to create that look on a clown mask that we were able to obtain. So everything about the clown is supposed to be so like the scares as well.
Yeah, well, it definitely works. And yeah, I love that late night haunt out where he keeps moving and he's just like holding the birth, like the candle and stuff like that. It's just like, that's like so innocuous, but it's so terrifying when it happens, because you're just like, what the hell is he doing?
Those are fun to film because those are like long one-off scenes, and they were scenes that were kind of wandering all over the hotel in like one shot.
Yeah.
And so they were fun because we had to choreograph that. It was like a lot of moving, but like a lot of people just like roaming around in the darkness, not like trying to see things when the camera's not turned their way. We're all like kind of like hopping around. And then, you know, the way we film it, you know, really can't really see how it looked. So what we do is like run a few takes of it, then we bring it to the monitor and then check it out and see like how many, like should we do more of it or not. But like at the time, I just yell out a big cut like throughout the whole hotel, hoping that everyone heard it. And, you know, and then try and like, then the lights would come on. Angie would be always be in the control room, get the lights up. And then I'd go up and be like, how'd it feel? How'd it look? You know, like, they're like, I was scared, but, you know, like, and I'm like, all right, that sounds good. Let's do another take. And then we'll look and see how it actually looked on camera. It was a little, it's just a little different style of filmmaking. You can't actually see the frame. You know, you're just telling the actors, like, make sure you get this frame. Make sure you turn this way. Don't ever do this with the camera. Make sure it looks like this. And then seeing what they did later on, like how the hell they pulled it off. That was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun making that.
Yeah, that actually reminds me. My wife and I are rewatching The Haunting of Hill House right now on Netflix. Oh yeah, and we just, because we're going to do the Bly Manor review later and stuff, and we just watched the episode last night, the one take episode where they're all at the funeral home. And
oh my god, that episode is just so, it blew me away. That is so amazing.
I can't even believe that episode every time I watch it. And I remember seeing a backstage. Yeah. Oh, that, I don't know if it won anything, but it got robbed if it didn't, because every time I watch it, I'm just struck with the logistics of it. Yeah. And I remember seeing a behind the scenes video where it like showed them like all the people moving when they moved the camera and stuff like that. Yeah, and so you're describing kind of sounds a little bit like that.
Yeah, although, I mean, like, the logistics of what they did, we did nothing on that well. But I know. I always think the same thing. I love, like, a really great one-off shot. Not done a lot in horror. And Hill House did it so so well. That episode was so terrifying, so well mm-hmm. not so well shot, had everything in it. I just love everything they did. I can go on and on about
yeah, yeah. No, but I digress. Okay. Hey, we're talking about Hell House here. Come on. Yeah, well, and you know, my wife and I, you know, we are horror film fanatics, have been ever since we met. Yeah. But what we're really drawn to are, like, not necessarily like slashers or you know, like, yeah. Or even violent stuff, is just we're really drawn to ghost and supernatural stories.
Me too.
And so that's what we loved about this, because there's like a whole lore that's attached to this hotel that we just barely touch on. And I love that, because it kind of gives us just that little bit more that we want to know. And so, like, you know, did you have that whole Andrew Tully, like, history of the hotel aspect in mind this whole time, or did that kind of evolve as well?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, the story evolved as I was writing. You know, like, it starts with the idea of a haunted house gone wrong. Mm-hmm. And then we go from there. Well, why did it go wrong? Mm. And then why did that happen? So we find out the why it went wrong, but then how did that happen? So we keep mm-hmm. on going back. And then, so then eventually, you know, when it comes to my writing process personally, is that, you know, you keep on going through the story and find out the whys, and you eventually get to the core, in which you come up with the Andrew Tully story. And so I thought that was fun. And I always wanted to tell more of that story. And so I had this whole backstory to the hotel and how it related to Hell House and what happened throughout the 80s and the 90s. And I realized, like, well, like, you have a 90-minute found footage film, so good luck trying to tell all that. So, we were able to come back and dive into a little bit more of the history and do that in 2 and 3, though. But the story was that story was already there. But I did like how we were able to. I think it worked out better that we didn't just, like, spill the story of Andrew Tully mm-hmm. and everything on in one. We just kind of left breadcrumbs to everything. And
absolutely.
And that's the kind of story I like the most. I think a lot of things where things aren't really answered, you have mm-hmm. to kind of think about it more. And I always tell people, like, there are answers. If you can get a lot of the answers in Hell House, but they're hidden. So you have to, there's like a little puzzle. And that's what I enjoy in a story as well. And I enjoy doing with Hell House is leaving clues around and Easter eggs around. And I think that makes it fun for people to watch again, as you were saying. And you know, and that's what I kind of want to do with any new film I make is kind of do that, kind of like leave a little bit of mystery there, but there are clues within the frames of certain shots that uh-huh. might help you solve those mysteries if you're looking in the right place. I enjoy that.
I'm going to keep trying to find them, man. I'll just keep messaging, like, is this one? I'll just annoy you to death. Just two real quick questions, just really inside baseball questions here, just about the movie itself. So one of the big scares is, of course, when Paul wakes up in the middle of the night and there's the ghost girl over in his corner. My wife seems to think that's the actress that played Melissa. Is that true?
No.
Okay. No. Good. I get to tell her she's wrong.
Yeah. No, Melissa's at, the two actors in my head, I'm trying to find out what similarities she put together on them.
Uh-huh.
One was the girl in Paul's bedroom was the owner of the haunt's daughter, who was 11 or 12 at the time. And she was great.
Very effective.
Yeah, she's great. And she, you know, she grew up with her mother making horror haunted houses. So, like, she has, like, at 11, she got it, you know.
She got
like
it, yeah.
She knew what she was doing and how scary she looked. But, and the other actress, Melissa, is just another actress we auditioned and hired from New York City.
Okay.
Who's a fantastic actress herself. I wish I had more scenes with Melissa because she's just a really good actress in person, too.
Oh yeah, that interaction with Paul in the trailer there was actually always really fun, where she gives us our little bit of backstory there.
She does that really well. Tell him just a little bit of backstory, like, you know, haven't you guys heard the stories about this place? And so we get a little taste of everything going on there, but we're not giving too much story. So
yeah, absolutely. All right. And the only other one here, like, there's a veiled thing that Sarah might have a connection to this place. The character of Sarah, I don't want you to give too much away because again, full disclosure, we haven't seen the sequels yet, but am I on the right track there?
Not what's there, no.
Okay.
That was fun. I think you might be referring to Danny, who plays Alex, has this bit of improv line when he picks up a piece of broken...
The plate, yes.
The plate, and he says, it almost looks like Sarah.
I think to be your grandmother, that, yes.
Yeah, your grandmother, yeah, yeah. So Sarah specifically, no, there are other ties to Hell House, the company, and Alex in general that are explored through in the sequels and will be explored more in a series actually we're developing right now nice. That goes back into the 80s, the 90s, up and through the Hell House saga. But it kind of like parallels everything that's going on in the trilogy, told from another angle. It's something we're kind of exploring those connections more though. But there are other connections there, but not specifically to Sarah. That was just a funny piece of improv that I think I can't remember if it was Paul or Alex who said it though, but because yeah. I mean that's something that would be like for no there are so many things we have in there that are like that, so I can see why you think like
I know that, and but, isn't yeah. that just like the horror film like trope thing that we're all planned to look for, you know, like ooh, innocuous line that might mean I know. Something like
I know that's cool. I mean I wish I was that clever to put the we didn't put that in there on purpose though, but the other things we did, some things we didn't, and the broken piece of plate that was not intended.
Oh well, there you go. Well, great misdirect. Well, Stephen, if you got one more minute here, of course we are in MonsterCast month here on NPR Illinois and the Front Row Network, and anybody who comes on here, we'd love to get what are your recommendations for horror films that people should watch during October. What's on your playlist for every October when it comes to horror films?
That's a good question because it's I like the ones that are going to put me in the. In the mood, there's a certain feel about October, that, you know, and horror films kind of just, and nothing, I don't think anything does it better than Halloween. I think, something more recent that just so perfectly encapsulates everything that is October is Trick or Treat.
Yes. We love that movie.
It's so good. And just so gets October. Everything about it just says, that's October.
That's always our Halloween. That's our first movie we watch every Halloween.
Yeah, that's good. The film I was mentioning before, something that a lot of people might not have seen, but that I just love. I think it's such a good, spooky, creepy movie. It has the same feel of Hell House. So if anybody's watching this is likes Hell House, it is Lake Mungo.
Right.
And so that is, you know, we were inspired by Lake Mungo, so that we, you know, tip our hats to Lake Mungo. And they, what they did was original and really well done, creepy. So it's just a docu-horror, a foul documentary, real shot to look real. Everything about it seems real, and that's what makes it so fun to watch.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for being here. If people want to find more from you to track the stuff that you're doing, where can they find you online?
I'm on Twitter, SAJC05. The weirdest Twitter handle I know. It's my initials 05. Cause I'm so clever. And, anything new coming up with like Hell House, the status of the series we're doing and everything like that, our Hell House, Facebook page, Hell House LLC Facebook page is the best place to, that's where everything gets updated about everything going on in the world of Hell House.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us again here on MonsterCast. Everybody go watch Hell House LLC if you haven't. It's going to be one of the best films you've seen all year. I promise you that. So, Stephen, once again, thank you very much for joining us here.
All right, thank you.
All right, so that was my interview with Stephen Cognetti. So freaking amazing that we got to talk to him and get some of those answers that we were asking for there.
Yeah, you're like kind of legit, aren't you?
Yeah, man, look at that. no, we really, really want to thank Stephen for giving us that time. You know, he's obviously very, very busy and stuff. And, you know, it's great that we can give the audience here on the network and NPR Illinois some more context for this movie. Please, 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 if you haven't been convinced yet, go watch Hell House LLC. It is going to surprise you are really, really gonna love it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so great. I think we're gonna probably watch the second one, maybe the third, we'll see. Thirds don't usually fare so well, but it actually is rated higher than the second one, so
well, look at that. So we'll just have to watch them both, I guess.
But it's called Lake of Fire.
Ooh, Lake of Fire, look at that. I like lakes and I like fire. Okay, so that is it for this MonsterCast on Hell House LLC. Sarah, what is coming up next on MonsterCast?
We'll do our franchise.
Yes, which is going to be...
I Know What You Did Last Summer.
That's right, man. We're going to have some fun.
Nothing, because it was coronavirus. Oh!
That's what look at that. All right, so that's going to be our next one for that, and then we are going to close it out on Halloween night with the ruins. So plenty more for look forward to here on MonsterCast, and trust me, folks, there is a lot more coming on MonsterCast from the Front Row Network. If you want to know any more about that, go to thefrontrownetwork.com or nprillinois.org/program/frontrownetwork. Find us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, search for the Front Row Network, and of course, follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. Anything else, Sarah, before we say goodbye?
Nope. I'm ready to peace.
It's all right. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to this MonsterCast Spotlight on Hell House LLC. I'm Jeremy Gechner.
I'm Sarah Baltusevich Gechner.
And we will see you in the front row. Bye.
Bye.